DeMarva Public Radio wishes to thank the Delaware chapter of the American Institute of Architects, as well as the staff of 16 Mile Brewing in Georgetown, particularly Angelina Eidler, for their cooperation in making this roundtable discussion a reality. Good morning and welcome to Delmarva Today. I'm Dana Whitehair, sitting in for Don Rush, who I hope is taking some time off this week while his general manager attempts to host a news and current affairs roundtable discussion program, hopefully without embarrassing myself. Don will be back in the producer's desk next week. I'm currently seated in Salisbury University's new Patricia R. Guerreri Academic Commons, a beautiful, open, engaging, and inspiring architectural marvel by any standard. This is a particularly appropriate setting since today's program is about the people and profession whose work, from concept to construction, surrounds us, both figuratively and literally. Architects. Most buildings you see, work in, or inhabit are the result of the work of an architect. But who are these largely unheralded people behind the designs? What led them to architecture? What inspires them? What guides them? What challenges, present and future, do they face as individuals and as a profession? We turn to four recent award-winning members of the American Institute of Architects, or AIA's, Delaware chapter. I ask each to introduce themselves and explain briefly why they chose architecture as a profession.
My name is Ed Rami. My firm is called Think Architecture. We are based in Kennett Square, Pennsylvania. I always seem to be kind of interested in spaces and buildings, and that evolved into taking architectural classes in high school and then followed through college.
So my name is Philip Conte. I am a principal at Studio Jade, headquartered in Delaware. You know, I don't know what drove me to be an architect. It always seemed to be the only thing that I was going to be able to do and at least satisfy that desire. It is truly a profession that you have to have passion for. You certainly want to love what you do. And I would say that that has probably been the key to my success so far.
My name is Scott Edmonston. I am the president and principal architect of a small firm in Bethany Beach called C Studio Architects. We specialize in just cool, fun, environmentally friendly houses, some commercial spaces. And I got into architecture because it's a profession where there is no right answer. So it's something where you're constantly exploring, constantly working, and creating. And it's a really fun way to make a living. And I love to draw, so I get to do both of those things every day at work.
I'm Layla Hamroon. I'm owner of Past Forward Architecture. I'm based in Newark, Delaware, and I specialize in mostly historic preservation and adaptive reuse. I'm originally from Algeria, so I first did my architectural studies in Algiers. I didn't know I'd be an architect. I loved history, I loved math, and I loved drawing. And I also loved reading. And at some point when I decided what I was going to do for when I got to college, I thought, well, what kind of brings it together? And there was architecture school. But they all come together because for me, architecture, yes, it's a technical challenge, it's a solution, but it's really about a story. And I love storytelling. So that's sort of what I do.
Being a late baby boomer, I grew up in the 1960s with the image of an architect as a stylishly dressed, pipe-smoking, dashingly handsome, sports car-driving, and rather well-off man in an office set aside in a modern steel and glass cubist home with a mind-blowing view of a picturesque urban landscape. There's an old saying in music journalism that states, writing about music is like dancing about architecture. It's a very subjective area to explore. There are so many intangibles, so many concepts like space and feel and wow moments above and beyond the challenges of building a safe, sustainable structure that will serve basic purposes. So we started with something tangible, the stated values of the American Institute of Architects, to which all its members adhere. They include standing for equity and human rights, for architecture that strengthens our communities, for a sustainable future, for protecting communities from the impact of climate change, for economic opportunity, for investing in the future, and for speaking up and influencing public policy. I asked the panel how the AIA's values are applied and how they guide them as professionals, architects, and successful business people.
That's exactly the challenge that we face every time we meet a new client. What you're asking somebody to do is to trust you with a lot of their money to create something, number one, something that meets the needs practically. It's got to be technically sound so that it doesn't leak, so that the lights don't go out. And that's one of the greatest challenges, because you are trying to inspire somebody using work you've already done to help them envision what it is that you're proposing. And even though some of us use models, some of us use drawings, some of us use animations and computer models, it's still a very different thing when the building is built.
I remember one of the first things someone told me as I was getting into this profession is that they said, you will be the first one hired and the last one paid. And I think we accept that because, as Ed said, we get to create. We take the intangibles and we make them into a place where people are every day. They work, they learn, they play, they sleep. And that's very rewarding. I do think architects are so gratified and satisfied by the process that we fail in a profession to capitalize upon it. One of the strategic goals of AIA is to elevate public awareness. Some of the greatest buildings that people will visit and see, the architect is probably unknown outside of the architectural community, and that is unfortunate. There are those high-profile projects that do get some attention, but not enough at the level that we all should be working towards.
There's a select few famous architects that people might know and recognize by name: Wright, Iampe, Frank Gehry, maybe a couple others, right? But part of that comes from the fact that architecture is a very introverted process. I mean, you sit with your sketchbook or your drawing table and you kind of hide it behind your arm while you're drawing, and you don't really want to show it to the world until it's ready. We're not doing this for the fame. We're doing it for the love, Phil, as you said, of the architecture, of the process. I was actually the mascot in college. And it's funny, I was famous when I was in the suit. I was an absolute no one when I was out of the suit. And architecture's like that. You're famous, you're recognizable when you're in the building you designed, and when you're working with the people who know you designed that building, and otherwise you are a complete nobody. But we don't do it for that. We do it because we love the part of the process of drawing, the process of building, and seeing our sketches turn into real stuff, and it's fun.
And I think to come back to one of the challenges, we say, how do I talk about it on the radio, and how do people understand the place of architects? I think if you step back, architecture is everywhere, in the sense that anybody sitting in their home, at their office, or us here talking around, you're in a three-dimensional environment that covers you, it shelters you, it keeps you warm, you have building systems that keeps you cool, all of that has been designed and devised with the help of architects. Now, what happens often, yes, you have the select few, the Pays, you know, the Frank Lloyd Wright, which we even studied. You know, I was doing architecture school in Algeria, and a big part of everybody that I was studying was the European and American great architects. But you also have a whole range of traditional or vernacular architecture. So what we have to explain to people think architect, and they think expensive, high-end, am I getting a designer dress? Versus no, you can go to all the department stores, or you can be, you know, working with somebody who's making your custom-made dress. Architecture is that. It's everyday architecture, and it's the select few. And I think we need to understand, if we do our job, and if we do it well, we do disappear in the process because we are interpreters. One of the conversations I often have with my clients, I'm like, it's not about my ego. You need my expertise because clients sometimes really know what they want. They have a feeling, they have a sense, they don't know how to articulate it. If I do my job right, I take this vision you have in your mind. It can be your dream house, like Scott, what you do. It can be this new building. It can be an office. It could be a new brewery. And I'm there to extract it from you, to take it, to translate it into those technical details, the relationship with the contractor. The emotional, I love the space, and the nitty-gritty. How many screws are going to go into this piece of wood or that sheet metal? And if I do it right at the end, it's your story that's the star. I'm the one that helped you get there. And yes, they'll all be select. I'm also the historic member on the Historical Area Commission in Old Newcastle. People think of Newcastle, they think the Green, the National District, you know, the courthouse. But people forget that 75% of historic Newcastle is the vernacular, workmen's homes that were built in the, you know, the middle 19th century. That's just as much architecture. When we look around us, those buildings, they are what tell our story, and that's where the community comes in. And what we have to do when we reach out, either for the single project or the larger project, a big part of what we do is we talk to people, not just the direct project, not just directly related to, but how do you want to reach out to the community? How do you want to explain how this all fits into the broader parameters, into what they're thinking? And I think if we manage that, then maybe people will start understanding how architecture is actually much more integrated and visceral than you realize it, but just open your eyes to it.
I think when we talk about the guiding principles, the first thing is that as architects, we have the responsibility to protect the life safety of the occupants. But once we have that accomplished, we want to elevate their understanding of the space, either through, you know, materials as Ed has suggested, or the quality of the space in terms of its historical context. A lot of our projects are institutional, where our greatest responsibility, next to protecting the life safety of the occupants, is maintaining a schedule and a budget, particularly when public funds are involved. There is a lot of scrutiny, a lot of accountability, and it becomes a challenge. There are three things of which I can only control two, and the third is a variable. And those three things are cost, quantity, and quality. You tell me which two are the most important to you, and then the third is going to be a variable. A lot of clients, those two things will be different. That's the challenge. We live for that challenge.
We all have this life safety, health safety, welfare requirement that we need to ensure the public safety. You've then got to make sure that your municipalities are on budget and on time. How do you make a building that inspires kids, that has these moments? And I've seen you all do it, so I'm interested to know how you, you know, navigate all that sort of requirement, all the, we'll call it the fine print, but then still do this really inspiring building.
It's quite a challenge. What we call that process is determining what those isolated wows are. So we determine quickly where those isolated wows are. We budget appropriately and so that we have some flexibility to do nicer materials. And the only way we can do that is when we design that into this process very early. As architects, we are most impactful when we move that effort as close to the beginning as possible.
And to build on that, one, you have the big picture, you know, climate change, sustainability, and I think pretty much that across the board, the notion of using sustainable materials, the notion of renewable resources. I totally agree with Phil. One of the most significant things that I do with all of my clients is I offer a very lengthy concept design phase. During that phase, we're going to look at multiple options. We're going to think through. We're going to hash out what is it that you're thinking about. How are we looking at it? Are there different approaches? Who do we need to talk to? And at that concept design phase, we don't just talk to the stakeholders. We'll talk to the governmental authorities. We'll talk to the local permit or code official. You have to have that time where you can think things through, because I've had clients who've come to me, they've been burned. They reached out to an architect, said, well, we did all that, and then when the bids came in, that was twice the budget, and we hadn't planned it. What are we going to do? So early on, you have the comfortable conversations. What do you want? What should it be? Where are we going to put it? It's exciting. What kind of materials? What's important to you? And then at that time, you also have to bring in what I call the less comfortable conversation, but are necessary. You want this? This is a preliminary budget. You want that? That's the preliminary budget. And what I tell my clients, I will tell you what you want to hear, but I'll also tell you what you need to hear and what you might not want to hear. I love the design portion. I love the sketches, but we're also diplomats. We're also interpreters. We're also a link. We're making sure that for our client, there's somebody that's reaching out and talking to all the different parties and giving them a sense of, we're trying to bring it together. in a process and framework where we'll all be pushing towards the same goal. And I think that's when we talk about the AIA's goals of sustainability, of engagement, of being part of the conversation and being receptive.
My experience in the United States is that people tend to think bigger is better. I live in a 5,000 square foot house, whereas you only live in a 2,000 square foot house. However, the 2,000 square foot house is built extraordinarily well. It's built of high-end materials, but the 5,000 square foot house is built of the cheapest possible materials legally available by code. And that's the thing that I don't find a lot of people understand about what architects can do. We can make smaller feel bigger. We can make small spaces feel comfortable by giving them detail. And what do people key in on when they go into old buildings? Wow, look at the details. Isn't that beautiful? But then when they buy a house or they move into an office space, it's so bare and stripped down, there's nothing of interest in the space. It's simply quantity as opposed to well-designed quality. And for me, that's where I go back to the ethics and the standards and the morals of the American Institute of Architects. It does promote finding ways to achieve quality, right? Philip was talking about targeted interest. Just saying that statement to me is beautiful, because what he's recognizing is that certain things are more important than other things, and you focus on those, and you try to make those the best you can with the money you have.
Of the three things that Philip mentioned, which of those things in each of your disciplines is the least considered by the client? I'm assuming that you run into some consistency in terms of those three. Which one ends up being the variable?
Very rarely is cost the variable. And on some of these larger projects, they have a program that would require a certain quantity of space. And quality is probably the variable that we are challenged with.
And since you're in residential...
Yeah, I mean, I would actually say for us, I mean, not to be a contrarian, but it's actually quantity that people are least likely to actually compromise on. We have to kind of push them into seeing that they can get exactly what they want out of a smaller space, that bigger isn't necessarily better. And that's one of the things that I did when we started our own firm. We built our own house. We kind of put our money where our mouth was. We built a 1,500 square foot house. We saw this sort of flooded market of gigantic boxes, particularly at the beach, where people just want the biggest house they can get because they felt like, well, this is a place where the whole family can be. And we wanted to show them that smaller, more flexible spaces could be beautiful, could feel just as big as these other spaces felt, and at the same time be energy efficient. Our house is net zero. It makes more power than it uses on an annual basis. It's a great place to hang out. We live here year round, so it's a great place to hang out at the beach in the winter because it stays nice and warm. And that ties back into the ethics question, which is you don't become an architect because you just like think you're going to make a ton of money. Or, as you said earlier, that you're going to sit around and drink wine all night and draw pictures, because in reality, what you do is type emails and talk to clients and make site visits. And those moments when you can draw are the precious few, not the large majority. So we set out to do this because we love it. And we care about the built environment, and we care about the people in the built environment. And so then I think each find our own ways to impart our own desire for our own specific thing. In my case, it's environmental concerns. It's all of that stuff, but the AIA standards is the baseline.
The thing in my field, most of the jobs that I do is I work on existing buildings, and they can be historic buildings on the National Historic Landmark. I have a couple projects there, or they could just be existing buildings that are 30, 40, or 50 years old. That just means that the structure behaves in a different way. I'm the advocate for the client, but I'm also the advocate for the building. And when we get into more of what's traditionally considered historic building, and we start looking at the fabric, that's when we start to have that tension about the quality. Well, why can't I put an engineered wood that's going to last 25 years? Well, because it's not going to age the same way as all the masonry and wood around it that's been around for 200, 250 years. And I embrace that because there's nothing like putting your hand on that stone or that piece of wood. You touch it and you know that 100 or 200 years ago, a craftsman was there and he touched it. And that's where we become the storytellers. But we always want to bring it to 21st century standards in terms of the expectations, the comfort, the safety.
The most important thing in the process, and I do residential work, I do higher education work, I do commercial work. The most important piece of the puzzle is the client. And I can give you an example. When I meet somebody, and they're looking to design to build a new house. And I've heard it a number of times. Oh, I don't need an architect. I can design my own house. And the exercise I've learned to do for myself mentally is I substitute another profession into that statement just to test its validity. It doesn't make sense in those other scenarios. And to me, it makes just as little sense when you're talking about an architect. When a client asks questions, when you make a suggestion to them, perhaps we should use this material here or organize the space in this way there, a good client will say, well, why do you think that that's the right thing to do? A client for whom I've built long ago never asked questions. They, oh, I don't like that. Oh, I like that. That was the measure that they used. And what I used to say to them is, you know, people like bad things all the time, and people don't like brilliant things all the time, right? The Eiffel Tower was considered vulgar and an abomination. Now we recognize its brilliance. And when you're suggesting something out of people's comfort zone for the betterment of the design, people need to take time to stop and think about it. And I think that that's what we're trained to do. Architect, the training of an architect is to be critical not only of what you see and experience, but critical of your own work. So you can stop yourself and say, is that the right thing for the building? I look for people who ask questions about who they are, where they are, what they want to do, how they want to live. And when I find somebody like that, I know that the project and the conversations that go on between us are going to be fabulous.
Yeah, that's why I think actually trust is one of the most important characteristics of a good client. And it's not blind trust, but it's just that they hire people they trust and then trust the people they hire. You know, you're going to say something that's wacky and out there, and they might challenge it, and that's great, and they might veto it, and that's also great. But if you can get two or three of those things in to your design and they trust you with it, and then in the end they walk into a space like this and say, oh, I had no idea it was going to be like that. It is beautiful. I could never have imagined it like this. Well, yeah, that's why you hired us and not drew it yourself.
And I think just to build on what each of you have been saying, and this is because of my perspective, I think we have this, what you said, the guidelines and the philosophy, and we're so much more than that. But I also think people need to understand right here in this room, we're a snapshot of the universality of what architecture can do. I mean, I started practicing architecture in Algeria. When people now talk about earthen architecture and traditional means as being most sustainable, that was part of my environment. But what you bring is you bring this universal approach to the fact that you're creating in stone, in mortar, here probably in wood or in metal studs, you're building a physical reality for somebody or an institution who's going to occupy it. It always was part of that language of taking an idea, giving it a physicality, trying to communicate that to the client, and after that there has to be a leap of faith that you will take that, interpret it into something physical and technical, and they walk and see it, and they're like, yes.
How does what Layla just expressed, how does it interlace itself with the artistic values of what you do? And also, do you consider yourselves artists?
Architecture is probably a high-risk profession. Your credibility is out there every day. Every decision can be traced back to you, and it could be difficult. I bet Scott's clients are quite challenging at his level. Television shows on HGTV where they can do these incredible makeovers in a half hour. How has that impacted some of your projects, your clients' understanding? I'd be curious to see the whole tiny house movement as well.
So it's not good as a succinct answer to it. I mean,
it's deceiving.
It's very deceiving.
It's very deceiving.
You see things where, as an architect, you watch a show like that and you see, oh, we did this all in 4 weeks and it was, you know, ahead of schedule and under budget. And no project in the history of construction has ever been ahead of schedule and under budget. So there are, you know, the big reveals in those shows where they say, oh, and we did all of this for $35,000. And you're, as a residential, custom residential architect, you're looking at the room full of furniture and saying that room full of furniture costs more than $35,000. There's not even room left in the budget for any of the construction activity that happened. To the layperson, to the sort of green client who's never worked with an architect before, who's never built something custom before, those shows give them a false sense of both buildability, affordability, and it makes it a little more of an uphill climb for us.
In architecture, there's no Nobel Prize, but there is a family who stepped up and they award a prize to one architect every year or a firm every year. It's called the Pritzker Prize. And one of the Pritzker Prize winners, a gentleman named Glenn Murcutt, he practices in Australia, and he builds these tiny little extraordinarily beautifully built houses. Beautiful work. And he has a quote where I think he sums up one of my personal beliefs very succinctly. Great poetic potential exists in the utilitarian. By its nature, a building needs to be used for something. It needs to be usable. If you can take those needs and craft them beautifully and make art out of them, the only downside is potential cost, in my mind. We want to make places that people are excited to be. People spend, I've read, 80 to 90% of their lives inside buildings or around buildings. Why wouldn't you want those to be beautifully made?
Yeah, I think we would all consider ourselves artists. We may not be 100% artists. I mean, there is a technician in there, but as architects, I think we have the soul of an artist.
The key thing that Scott mentioned that's critical is the balance, because we have all seen these designs that are very much an artistic expression, but they aren't thought out in terms of scale of the people who are using them. And I think that goes back to when you said, well, people think of the diva. You were saying, you know, the well-dressed and obviously a gentleman, very few women in that group. And coming from an Arab Muslim country, I had some very interesting experiences when I went on job sites early on. So I think, yes, if you want to get away from that, it's coming down from above, then we have to, as a profession, explain to people that we understand that. We know it's not about us controlling the whole process. It's about us working with you, the client, and the other people you bring to the dance to make sure that our dancing and architecture is successful.
Historically, what have been the major mileposts which have affected architecture as an industry and architecture as a profession since, let's say, the 1800s that have been not just mileposts, but also bellwether changes in how people think, how they design, how architecture is accepted and viewed in society, and how have they built upon one another to affect what you do now?
I think technology, but for two different reasons. When you start looking at the work environment and the buildings that Facebook and Google are designing and creating, that has changed the direction of office environment and office planning. And that became evident because of the way they work, a more collaborative process required a different type of facility. They had the reason to do it, they did it, and people are seeing that it's effective and it's transitioning the whole design of office space and interiors. And also the use of technology in terms of what they're doing, like Elon Musk and his drive towards sustainability. It's pushing the boundaries of architecture technically in the building envelope and how alternative resources and power can be brought into the building. So the use of technology in creating buildings that are more sustainable, more alive, more living.
That's That's a hard question. There really aren't. I think it's constantly changing. But when you asked the question, I was thinking back to a lecture that I attended. There's a gentleman named Tom Main. He's an American architect, works out on the West Coast. And in the lecture, he was talking about working in China. And when he was a young up-and-coming architect, he was told by a more senior-level architect, if you want to experiment with your architecture, you're going to have to go overseas. And for me, that was a very sad statement. But he followed it up by making a comment about working with a couple of different Chinese companies. And he said, the companies, the people who I work with over there, seem to understand something important that Americans seem to have forgotten. That architecture possesses great symbolic power. And I think in the early part of the 20th century, the United States was that up-and-comer. I think we were the ones, right? Thomas Watson, who was the head of IBM in its heyday, was famously said, good design is good business. I don't meet a lot of people who have that kind of grand or objective in their minds and in their hearts anymore when it comes to building a building. A building's a building, and we got to get it built. We got to get it built on time. We got to get it built on budget. But there's no grander statement that they're making with the building. And in that quote by Tom Main, it was a hard thing to hear as an architect in the United States. I'm hoping it's not true. I'm hoping it turns around. But I agree with Philip. I mean, technology has such an effect on everything we do almost daily. But I do think it's cultural. I think it's shifts in the culture have a great impact on what gets built and why it gets built.
Something that Phil said kind of brought back a different perspective. You're talking about technology. When you talk about the Facebooks and you say they work in a different way, they work in a collaborative way, so the space needs to be different. What I've been thinking more as general trends is before and even up until the 18th century, there wasn't really an architect. There were a few. By the 18th century, you had a few architects. But before, it had always been the master artisan, the master builder. He was the one who designed, you know, the cathedral and did all of that. And then over the 18th century, particularly 19th century, you started having the few names, the architects kind of stepping out. But you still kept on having that master builder for a lot of the vernacular architecture. And it's mostly in the 20th century that you start having, with all the movements in Europe and post-World War and the Reconstruction, and you start having the industry establishing itself, first in Europe and in the US, and all that blossoming of the architect as more of a separate individual. But I think part of where we're circling back towards that is with this technology, we are getting to an ethos where it's becoming more natural to think of processes as being very collaborative. So there are a number of equals in terms of who are the key decision makers, the stakeholders. And I'm wondering if that's in a way how we're circling back to diluting a bit the architect, because technology, not in terms of what's accessible or like the innovations, but just in design. The fact that you can do all these incredible 3D modelings and renderings, and the contractors can kind of literally online be able to position where this pipe is gonna go within, you know, a 16th of an inch. Does that mean that they feel they have more of the wherewithal to sort of take all those components of the technical design that the architect did and think, well, we can do that, and maybe you're just there to give us the parameters? So I'm wondering if we're going to see that shift start and change a bit the balance of how we operate and sort of dilute ourselves a little bit.
I actually sort of see a little more of an architectural renaissance right now, specifically in my area. And Ed and I have talked about this a little bit, but with the rise of like Houzz and Pinterest and HGTV and those sorts of things, for all of their budgetary problems and their scheduling problems, they do shine a light on good design. And so you can't go anywhere right now without people asking you if you know Chip and Joanna Gaines from the show, whatever, it's Fixer Upper or something. So you see that people have access, easy access to photos, to images, to video of maybe not great design, but good design. And so, you know, we have clients all the time that find us through Houzz by they've seen pictures online. They just sort of dream online by looking at photos. And they're not dreaming of your typical colonial, you know, vinyl-sided box anymore. They're starting to look at stuff that's outside their comfort zone. But they see, our clients are now seeing cool pictures of different spaces, and they're coming to us with a desire for that.
I think the 20th century is the second renaissance. Space travel, air travel, all sorts of new technological developments in building, in printing, in the onset of the internet. And how can architecture not reflect all of those sorts of innovations and advancements? I go back to the person who says, well, I want a new old house, and I would just stop after a new house. It can be built with respect to older buildings. It can reflect older detailing. But if you're going to spend that much money, why make a copy? And why make a copy out of plastic? This is your home. It says something about you.
It's always been that interesting contradiction where when we talk about a historic district, people always come and say, well, why can't I use engineered wood and things like that? And I try to explain that whole thing about fabric because it's been here. But I say, but if you want to do new construction in this empty lot, absolutely use 21st century elements. You know, we can, as long as we work on scale and rhythm, I think it would be great, a great way to experience, you know, and let's go with trying steel and glass and things like that. Oh, no, no. If I want to build something, I want it to be, you know, colonial, brick, you know, simile wood and things like that. And so that's where you have that inner contradiction. I want the 21st century, but if I'm building an old, it has to look a certain way. I, as a preservationist, think it would be fabulous that you'd be in a historic district and have a 21st century home that respects everything in terms of the scale and the flavor and the rhythms, but it's very much, hi, I'm here. I'm the addition, you know, I'm the great-great-great grandchild that's joining the street in this historic streetscape.
All of that goes back to what Dana was asking about originally, about the technological or the advancements since the 1800s or something. You know, there are no new ideas, I mean, or there are very few. We sort of stand on the shoulders of giants. We're looking at work that has been done. We're looking at historic buildings and saying, okay, this is the correct proportion for this. This is the golden ratio. This is the way things should be. But in our own practice, we're looking at it and saying, well, we don't want to design a school or a house or a historic building necessarily that looks like it was always there. It looks like it belongs next to a historic building, but it was clearly built in 2017, clearly of its time, of its place. That's a challenge. It goes back to the artistry of it. And, you know, we're part historian, part technician, part artist, it's all of it.
How difficult is it to sell sustainability, even though it is very hot topic, and it's obviously very important to American society, but how do you go about selling that to somebody who wants pie in the sky?
Architects better be salesmen, otherwise they're not going to be in business
very long. Salesmen with integrity.
That's like public radio.
Like you, Dana.
Yeah.
The future of architecture is awesome. On what lies ahead, who knows? Children, as they're experimenting with computer games, Minecraft, and all those SimCity opportunities for them to learn to create, I can only imagine what it will be like. I would say that architects, at least in my sector of larger public-funded projects, use technology to compensate for a decline in craftsmanship. We are approaching a significant drought of tradesperson who actually are learning a craft to build what we are designing. The trades are simply not there, and they are declining.
Well, it makes a lot of sense for somebody to go to trade school. It makes a lot of sense for somebody to build that trade, and that's a job. Coping crown molding, for instance, is not something that can be done, at least not right now, by a computer, and not likely to be done because it's not repeated enough to be done by a robot. So you think that's going to come back?
I hope so. I mean, it needs to.
Is there an economic incentive for it to come back?
Absolutely. Absolutely. For example, if you were to look at the Delaware prevailing wage rates for a trade, it is significant. It is high. I would not be surprised if some of the homes that Scott is designing down at the beach are for plumbers and electricians who can afford a second home at the beach. I hope that that changes because we need those trades. Otherwise, our designs will go unbuilt.
the interesting question here for me is, I think you know, craft and tradesmanship and a lot of the work where I do, you do need to have that apprenticeship in learning the craft. And it goes back to that notion of respect. And I think what Phil is saying is craftsmanship is rediscovering a new respectability because people are seeing that, you know, in terms of the financial investment of college education, the return, and things of that nature, which is a good thing. And I think what's probably the direction I see it going is it's going to have to be, just like in my buildings, a meeting of both, because craftsmanship, it's not just a skill, but it takes time. There has to be a place where perhaps we try as architects to shape the narrative of where technology is going, not that we're recreating or taking away from the craftspeople, but for having a conversation with craftsmen and look at technology, say, where can this be something where there's a meeting of the mind?
Yeah, I see this respectability, like Layla, you were saying, towards tradespeople now. And, you know, you were saying that some of our clients are plumbers and electricians. Like, yeah, but most of our clients are like lawyers and doctors and financial people. They're coming from D.C. where they've made a bunch of money, or New York where they've made a bunch of money in the financial markets. But they look at what the guys on site who have built something that they could never even dream of building as geniuses. To a person, every one of them sees work built by these tradespeople, by the craftsmen, that they realize they couldn't do, you know, that they're never going to be able to do, and they respect it. And they, you know, so I think there's a renaissance in that too, and I think that's coming.
I think the challenge before the architect is not to lament the loss of the buggy whip craftsmen, but to find ways that the talents that are out there can be leveraged to their greatest extent. I don't think the challenge is being able to cope crown molding properly. I think the challenge is, how do we make something that does what the crown molding does in a new way that doesn't require that skill anymore?
What was it in your work, in that specific work upon which your award was based? What was it about each of your projects that you feel won an award?
I think the award is a way of saying that there's something above average or something exceptional about what was done. What motivates the drive to do something exceptional? If I had hair, it would be what blows my hair back. And I get excited when I'm working on a problem and I find a way of resolving that problem in a way that I haven't experimented with before, that I haven't used before, that I haven't seen before. It's very exciting. It's that kind of visceral, the gut reaction that motivates you to want to create something fun, something interesting. And, you know, like with Philip doing a school, he's affecting hundreds of children. If you walk through the places and spaces of these buildings that do win awards and you watch people, and you see the effect that it has on them. People looking around, they're looking at the details, they're oohing and aahing. They're enjoying their spaces, they're enjoying the place where they're spending their life.
I'd say the awards are really an opportunity to share amongst our peers some concepts that you may have explored that someone else may not have yet or hasn't had the opportunity to. But it's not so much the specific award as much as the whole idea of recognizing good, better, best work amongst all of us as a profession to help each other raise our quality of design. You know, there are 100,000 registered architects, and 1% of them are registered and licensed in Delaware. And out of that 1%, only 10% live in Delaware. So we have a very shallow pool, but a very talented, highly skilled, and highly diverse pool. And we use those awards programs as the vehicle to share and to exhibit our work.
We won an award last year for a house we did on the oceanfront. You know, I think one of our biggest motivations behind even submitting for the award process, even sharing the work, is not to get the confirmation from our peers that the work is good. I mean, we can get that by texting people photos. Ed and I text photos of our work back and forth all the time and help boost our egos a little bit. It's not for the recognition. it's that sharing process. And specifically, to go back to the craftsman issue, it's to like help share what we've done with the craftspeople that built it. So the house that we won an award for was made special, not just because we were involved, and really is a small percentage of because of us. It was because of a really great client who wanted to do something special, because of a really talented builder and the craftspeople below that builder who saw the work on paper and were inspired to make that even better than it was, and also a really talented interior designer that saw what we had put together from an architectural standpoint and married to that a bunch of beautiful finishes and this sense of home that the drawings alone weren't going to create. So it took a good architect, a great client, a great builder, and a great interior designer to make an award-winning project. And we see this award process as not only a marketing thing, because it's obviously that, but it's also a way to help recognize those people. And the builder for that house proudly displays his copy of the AIA award behind his desk. He's smiling from ear to ear in the pictures that made it in the Cape Gazette and things like that. So, you know, that's a really special thing for us to be able to share that and to recognize those people who, you know, that we're sort of standing on the shoulders of.
I think the most recent award that I got was Preservation Alliance. It's part of the work that people don't think about as much when they think architects. You know, they think architects, they think drawings and sections and constructions, but there's a large part that's also feasibility studies and planning. And that one was a community award for the Friends Housing Cooperative, which is the country's first integrated HUD-funded co-op in the country, which was done in the 1950s, and in a time where urban renewal meant to tear down and rebuild, it was actually the adaptive reuse of a whole block of late 19th century duplexes or townhouses. And they created into this haven of about 80 apartments, and they tore out all the courtyards in the back and turned it into one central courtyard. The award was for actually working with the cooperative to get it listed on the National Register. And what it recognized was the story and the journey. And that circles back when we started the conversation about why we do this. And it's about taking a story that needs to be heard, needs to be learned from. And it gives a pride to the members of the co-op who've been working hard and often unknown and people not realizing with very little money to do the step-by-step, day-by-day work. And by pulling the story, it made them discover things that they did not know about how they got there and the history and the fact that it was recognized as being significant at the state level and even potentially at the national level. So we'll be doing additional research. But I think our job is we have the privilege of bridging the dream and the reality, and we anchor it. And for me, the awards is a way to recognize my client who've chosen to go the difficult route of anchoring whatever their dream might be, the home, the school, you know, the museum extension, and they should be thanked for that beyond their satisfaction. And I think that takes that recognition outside of the realm where people could see, okay, then what, maybe we should try to go down that route, and how could we learn from that?
I do think architects really should try to influence public policy at a higher level. I have some dire concerns about our profession, not architecture in general, because I think that's going to be awesome, but the profession I have some concerns about. When the artistry is lost and institutions or homeowners think that we are a commodity that is price-based as opposed to quality-based, that's a lot of dangerous waters ahead. And it's incumbent upon us to be that salesperson that lets the people and public know the importance of an architect. The master builder, the architect as master builder, is no more. And we have to be very cautious that we don't lose more ground. And a way to influence that is to get more involved in the public and in policy.
Philip talks about public policy, and I agree. There is a lot of power in making sure that rules, regulations are important. I think if people want something, it happens. If people don't want something, it doesn't happen. When I listen to people talk about what kind of car they want. Oh, I want the leather seats. I want the heated. I want them to be heated. I want the alloy wheels with the wide speed rated tires. But then you ask them about their house. I want it to be as big as possible, made of the lowest quality materials acceptable by law. And that's where it stops. There's a real disconnect about what the culture values. But I'm a big believer. If the culture wants it, it happens. Not having the architect, you're missing that overarching planning ability to look at a project from day one, sketch one, to putting flowers on the table.
The next 50 years are going to be critical to our future as humans on Earth. So I think, at least in my mind, there's no doubt that the climate's changing, that sea level rise is a real issue that we need to deal with. And you look at Delmarva specifically, we're on the front lines of sea level rise here. We're very low. We're building houses right on the beach or right on the bay. So as architects, we have a responsibility over the beauty of the built environment. But more importantly, especially as we move forward, I think it's going to be the resiliency of the built environment to design more resilient, more efficient, just better buildings that are going to be able to stand up to the changing environment, that are going to be able to be beautiful but also practical. There's a stronger storm that hits the coast here, that they're going to be able to hold up to that. Any bunker builder could come out and design a concrete building with no windows that will hold up to that storm, but that's not why people come to the beach. That's not what we as architects want to do, as the artists within us want to do. So I see people really turning to architects for this. And not because, and to go back to something Dana said earlier, you know, how hard is it to sell people on sustainability? Well, it's not that hard anymore, because for me at least, because their kids are selling them on it. You know, we have kids that are saying, you know, this is important to me. And their parents are saying, okay, well, if it's important to you, it's important to me. And at the same time, build all of these resilient kind of design solutions into our plans that they might not know about or might not care about, but it means that, hey, that's a house that's going to be there. And I see that as our role. We're really on the front lines, or at least one of the front lines, of combating climate change.
What we have to acknowledge is architecture as a field, we're so tremendously different. We all have very different reaches. We all have very different perspectives. We also are perceived differently. But what I would tell to lay people is, you may have assumptions. They may be warranted or not, but reach out to us. Let's have a conversation. Talk and let's see. How can we explain what we do? How can we explain the value of what we might bring? How can we explain you could look at the project and think about it differently? And it can only start with that conversation if they have a sense of comfort, that they're not coming to a profession of arrogance, that they are not coming to a profession of egos, that they are coming to a profession of people whose original intent and core philosophy is, we need to listen to what you want and what you need, and then we will help you reach that point. Architecture is not just about the extravagant. Architecture is about every day, and every day is not a bad word. Every day can be beautiful. Every day can be gorgeous. Every day can be experienced in so many different ways. And I think we need to work to trying to start that dialogue, to remove that myth around the profession, but to let people know that we are accessible and we're willing to talk.
I really do appreciate y'all taking time to speak with us.
Thank you very much, Dan.
Did we get everything covered?
No.
Not
even close.
That's the entire practice of architecture.
Not even close.
Yeah. It didn't even come close to all the questions I wanted to ask either.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Okay.
This has been Delmarva Today, exploring both the work and world of architecture and architects, with Ed Rami of Think Architecture, Philip Conti of Studio Jade, Scott Edmonston of C Studio Architects, and Layla Hammeroon of Past Forward Architecture. Links to their firms are on our website, delmarvapublicradio.net. Special thanks to Angelina Eidler and the entire team at 16 Mile Brewing in Georgetown, Delaware, for their gracious hospitality and cooperation with the production of this program. For more on the Delaware chapter of the American Institute of Architects, visit aiadelaware.com. delmarvatoday.org. Delmarva Today is a production of Delmarva Public Radio, the public radio service of Salisbury University here in beautiful Salisbury, Maryland, center of the known universe. Comments and questions about this program should be addressed to dpr@salisbury.edu or by calling us at 410-543-6895. Don Rush will return next week. For Delmarva Today, I'm Dana Whitehair. Thank you for listening. This is WSDL Ocean City, 90.7 FM, Rhythm and News from Delmarva Public Radio. Testing, 1, 2, 3, is this thing on? Whoa there, public radio ranchers, it's me again, your friendly neighborhood public radio general manager, Dana Whitehair, also known to some of you Facebookers as Dana Delmarva. The program you just heard and hopefully enjoyed and found enlightening costs a lot of money to produce. Week in and week out, Don Rush and Christopher Rank and a surprisingly small number of others make this program, Delmarva Today, happen. Hopefully, it means enough for you to stop what you're doing, get up, or reach across your desk, or grab your cell phone, pull over, and call in a donation to Delmarva Public Radio right now. The number's 410-543-6895. 410-543-6895. I'm not joking, my friends. We need your financial support to not only keep Delmarva Today on the air, but also the rest of the programming you've come to expect on Delmarva Public Radio, whether it's NPR or PRI or APM News and Information or entertainment programming, Native Voice One music programming in the afternoons and overnight, classical music from Performance Today or the classical music that we play throughout the day, or the increasing amount of regionally produced Delmarva-grown programming from right here on WSDL and on WSCL 89.5 FM. That includes KT Tuminello's new program, Delmarva Groove, a stupendous three-hour music journey through KT's mind and music collection, airing tonight and every Friday night on this very station at 8 p.m. Tune in. You'll love it. KT told me you would. Right, KT? I thought so. Don't you send enough of your hard-earned money to Washington, D.C.? Why would you send your hard-earned public radio dollars to Washington, D.C., too? Keep your public radio, as well as your public radio dollars, here on Delmarva. Delmarva Public Radio is this peninsula's own public radio station. Don't be fooled by imitations or by stations from across the bridge trying is the operative word there, to serve Delmarvans. D.C. is D.C., Delmarva is Delmarva. We can serve Delmarva, and we do, with your help. We're here every day. They're not. You're listening to Delmarva Public Radio right now. Support the station you listen to. Have I mentioned 410-543-6895 lately? I didn't think so. 410-543-6895. Or you can go online, delmarvapublicradio.net. Click on Donate. It's a big red button at the top right. You can't miss it. It's Friday. You're already feeling good. You'll feel downright giddy when you complete your donation to DPR. 410-543-6895. Or go online to delmarvapublicradio.net. Chris Rank has the big hook in his hands, and he's about to pull me away from the microphone. Call us now, please. Thank you for listening to Delmarva Today. Thank you for supporting DPR. I'm Dana Whitehair, or Dana Delmarva, or both. And this is WSDL, Ocean City, 90.7 FM, Rhythm and News Radio from Salisbury University, and from you, our listeners. Call us now. Thank you, public radio ranchers. Have a great Labor Day weekend.